Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour, March 28th, 2013, and we've crossed into spring, of course, and not quite spring-like weather for the most part of the nation. The east once again getting pummeled with a major winter storm, basically on the first day of spring, so into spring. So anyway, not sure what this summer will bring. Tonight's main science topic, I will be continuing and expanding on the theme of last week. Last week, I talked about spectral analysis of comets. Now, a lot of people out there are thinking this is getting rather technical. And yes, it is, and it's going to get more technical. I want my audience to be the best educated audience on the planet. And to do that, and I'll be reviewing this as with any class or lecture, we'll go through it. You can have time to digest it, listen to the show, re-listen to the show like last week's show. This week's show, I will be concentrating on a topic, measuring the nuclei of comets. How do you measure the comet nuclei? Because you can't really see it. And so that's a topic that there are many, many aspects to. Before I get into that, I want to touch on a few other topics. First of all, before I forget, on my webpage, the new book, the e-book, Comets, and the five-book set of my previous existing books, we're somewhat on the honor system. And we started noticing people downloading the books and not paying for them, not completing the orders. And so actually it's unfortunate, but I know that the vast majority of people out there paid for the books before they downloaded them, but we had to go to the away from the honor system. And now the email links, we manually email the links to the people who ordered, which takes up a lot of time because every order is different. People order various things, so we have to go through each order and then email, mouse copy the email address and send the person the appropriate links for what they ordered. So anyway, I guess in this day and age, you just can't trust the public in general. My audience, I have a wonderful audience, and I'm sure the 99.9% of all of my good fans out there paid and then downloaded the books. But at any rate, it got to be to the point where, no, we said, no, we have to forget the honor system. And so anyway, when you order the books now, you will get an email, and we have to send them out manually because we can't trust the government from getting in there and sending other things with email. So the only way we can really control that outside of an automated system, which typically ebooks are sent through an automated system, but when it comes to my ebooks, there's a different story. I can't trust the government to try and get in there to start hacking around or sending other emails. You understand what I'm talking about. Diversionary tactics. Earlier in my career, my webpage had all kinds of, they call it typo squatting, where you would change one letter. And so I talked to somebody at Internic at the time. This was probably 10 years ago. And the woman said, I've never seen anything like this. She said, every possible combination of missed letters or duplicated letters in your web page URL name, they've been purchased by the same group. And then when you go to those sites, it was things that you didn't want to see. Let me tell you, that's and that was a way they were working way back then to try and slam me, to try and negate my work. But so this has been constant. There's nothing new here. It's just that now they are finding new, more advanced techniques to hack my webpage. So as I said, the only safe way for us to send out the email confirmations is manually. So at any rate, that's the story there. But anyway, I suggest if you have not gotten the books yet, and by the way, with this year coming up, with the comets coming in, we'll have the comet coming in April called Comet Lemon, C2012 F6 Lemon, will be very visible in April, much more visible than the Pan-STARRS comet. A lot of the people in the southern states have gotten a view of Pan-STARRS, the comet that's currently up there, but it's smaller, not as visible, and not as exciting. But the comet Lemon will be much more exciting, a green comet. Now, I've talked before about what makes comets green and other colors, and the lie, of course, that they're trying to propagate, and not very successfully, in the standard news media, that that's due to reflected sunlight. Well, sorry, that isn't the case. This is illumination. It's the comet lighting up like a light bulb, literally, because of the electric current flowing through it. Okay, and this is, by the way, why I am giving these somewhat advanced lectures. So you're going to need to read my books. You're going to have to read the comets book to really get your teeth around what I'm talking about here. And so you'll be educated when these comets roll through. Also, this fall, Comet Ison rolling through starting in September. I'll be talking about that. But to understand what you're looking at, and understand what NASA is releasing for data, what I call powder puff data, and why they're not releasing the good stuff to the public, which would prove my theories correct, which would absolutely disprove anything they're saying. So they're going to try and squeeze by slipping out this powder puff data and hope that the public buys off on it. Well, my audience is going to be very well educated, and when they see it happening, they're going to know that NASA is hiding data. And obviously, it's data they're taking, but I'll be talking more about that. Anyway, this week's main science topic, measuring comet nuclei. Very complicated topic. But once again about the books, just to remind you, you can buy the new book, Comets, in ebook format only. It's only available in ebook, $16.95 on my webpage, jmccsci.com. Or if you buy the complete set of previously available books, for $65, you get the new book free. And that's really the best deal. And I would suggest that even if people have already purchased the books in print form, to go in, grab the full set of books in e-format, and then you've got them with you. You can carry them with you. I know people that have them in their phones. In fact, I downloaded some into a phone just to try it out. It loaded perfectly, ran perfectly. Anyway, okay, that's enough on the books. And don't forget the water filter products. Go to the web page, the sales secure web ordering page. We now have the stainless steel canisters in stock again. That just happened. So if you've been sitting on the shelf thinking about ordering a stainless steel water filter, I'm probably one of the only places on the planet that have these now. So get in there and order soon, because they're not going to last, and they're just getting harder and harder to get. So it's $274 for a stainless steel with four filter elements, and then make sure you get the add-on arsenic and fluoride add-on filters, because you don't want to be drinking that fluoride. Believe me, that is chemical sludge that you do not want in your body. Those are the arsenic add-on filters that you can add on to your and of course I have my name brand filters. You can still buy the Daltons there, but it's about $100 more. At any rate, then we have the pre-filter that would filter sludge and water, bad water, out of your water system before it goes into your filter. You have the modular filtration and storage system, up to 20 gallons of stored water, filtered and stored water, using the new dome elements. We've got the new dome elements available and then the recalendar Sunstar clock, where you can learn the clock and calendar using the sun and stars as they currently are. And then if there's ever an emergency, you can quickly rebuild the calendar and the clock in one night viewing and have your own timepiece, both calendar and clock. So anyway, not to mention all the books, DVDs. A lot of people now are ordering that two CD set, the 18-hour lectures, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, just a really important piece of work. That's the two CD set, and it's fairly inexpensive. I forget what the price of that is, but well worth the cost. Okay, on to a couple topics here. First, I'm going to dive into some emails that have come in from listeners. Okay, here's one from a listener. It says, "Hi, Jim. I've got three emails here that I want to recount and give answers to on the air." It says, "Hi, Jim. I have a question for you. I've read all your books, including most of the new one, but I've missed something critical so far." So this is a listener not understanding one of the points I make in my books and lectures. He says, "One thing you see, I see you mentioned several times, but I missed picking up the reason, and that's the crossing of the planetary ecliptic plane and how at that moment there is an electrical reaction between the comet and the sun. What condition causes this to happen? Etc." So the question is, and I've talked about this many times, where the comet is crossing the ecliptic plane and it seems to jump into an excited state. This is first of all, it's empirical. It's observed. It's something that way back when comets were first observed, observation occurred. And so, of course, in my studies, I appreciate listeners asking these kind of questions because it's not so obvious. It is in my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. I do discuss this, and I believe it might even be some footnotes in the original three-part comet paper. So it is one of those more esoteric points. But here is what happens. To understand this, let's first go out to the planet Saturn. Saturn has that beautiful ring system. It's not even a mile thick. It's very, very thin. And Saturn is a big planet. Saturn is a very large planet, much, much larger than Earth. But it's a gas planet, and it has a ring system. Jupiter is the same, and the Sun is the same. There's something you can see at a couple different times of the year, and that's when Earth actually moves a little bit out of the plane of the Sun. We're not perfectly in the plane of the rings of the Sun, but the Sun has a Saturnian-like set of rings around it. A lot of iron in there, a lot of other metals, heavy metals, etc., in that ring. You can see this. It's called the zodiacal light, and that's kind of with the zodiac. I call it the zodiacal light. I think that's a better pronunciation. But in astronomy circles, they call it the zodiacal light. But at any rate, the zodiac is, the 12 seats of the division of the sky into 12 parts. But the zodiacal light, so to speak, is that Saturnian type of ring system that surrounds the Sun. And now let's go back out to Saturn. Saturn is a small star. It supports fusion. The fusion, and this is in my early papers, including the ones that were peer-reviewed in astrophysics journals when I was at Cornell. I did manage to get a few papers published before they slammed the door on me. But the rings of Saturn are very electrically active, and it's because they're like a big finger sticking out in that electric field, the capacitor, the fusion-based capacitor that surrounds Saturn. Jupiter is the same way. When things cross into that plane, zap, 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 a lot of electrical activity, the little moon Io moves around in that plane. So that's why Io is very much electrically connected to Jupiter. So anyway, okay, let's get back to comets crossing the ecliptic. When comets cross the ecliptic, they extend out the electrical connection along the ecliptic or the equator of the sun. Just a second. Where is my... Just a second. Okay, so that is why when comets cross the ecliptic plane, they jump into an excited state, is because there is one other factor there. That is the zodiacal disk of the sun, which is an electrically active disk around the equator of the sun. Okay, so that was a really good question, and it allows me then to jump into some of these more esoteric points of my theoretical work and let you, the public, know. So anyway, the point is that we're going to see this with Comet Eisen. We just saw it with the comet Pan-STARR. As Pan-STARR crossed the ecliptic, it really became very excited. We saw it with Comet Holmes. There's many, many examples. There were two little comets back in 2004. I had an observing session with amateurs around the world. Just as those crossed the ecliptic, we looked and observed sunward spike activity. So this is an observed phenomena. It also happened with Comet Hale-Bopp as Hale-Bopp crossed the ecliptic. And I remember that was something that I had predicted, to watch for sunward spike activity as Hale-Bopp crosses the ecliptic. And boy, did the standard scientific community jump in there. And they were, they just couldn't bend far enough to tell you how, that was just some rocks that happened to come off the nucleus at that time. Just garbage fairy tale science. But they have to maintain that image that they're somehow correct. Anyway, okay, so that's a great question. There's actually a second question in this email, and it says, this is from this guy's son. It says, if the Earth has seen all that oil and water from the comet tails, then why doesn't the moon show signs of oil and water formation? And that's a great question, too. And so I'm glad these kids are thinking along lines of my theoretical work. It's a good question. In fact, we do see water activity, little riverbeds, things like this on Mars. We see flows. We see areas where the surface is extremely black, which would indicate basins where oil had accumulated. But remember now that the moon does not have an atmosphere. So what happens when oil hits the moon, coming these hydrocarbons from comet tails and water, what happens when it hits the moon? Well, some of it can be absorbed. And so I'm suspecting that we will see, as the investigation of the moon continues, we're going to see the bigger hydrocarbon change, the thick oil, the tar-type oil, in the surface of the moon. The more volatile small hydrocarbons like benzene, etc., those will be long gone. Those will be evaporated away out into outer space, so you won't find those on the moon like you would find them on Earth, or natural gas or other volatiles. So at any rate, the answer is that, yeah, the moon will have some water and some oil buried in the surface. So at any rate... That's a great question, and that was actually one of my predictions, because if you find oil on the moon, then it's not from dinosaurs or fern forests, because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. And so then you'd have to see standard science community squirm and squiggle and bring up more Band-Aid theories to account for that. So that's a real good question. Show topic number two. Here's a really interesting set of comments. This comes in from a listener. Says, Jim, I wrote you a message about 4 years ago about Comcast disconnecting my internet and TV, everything. I decided to write to the National, so he's recounting what happened. He had written to the National Weather Service, and I understand this is NOAA, so the National Weather Service, after reading my weather book, and was curious to see how they would respond regarding the material. He went to their internet site and sent the comments questions directly to them on their website. He left to go pick up his wife from the airport, and when he returned, everything was down, meaning his TV, his internet, his phone, everything that he got from Comcast was down. And he never received a response from the National Weather Service regarding his inquiry. Okay, so he calls Comcast and was very upset. Said the people on the phone did not have any clue why his service had been disconnected. They did note that the technician had written "hot home," that's H-O-T, "hot home," in the log after disconnecting the service. He went to a new project in another city later and met with a former Comcast employee in the office. The formerly employee of Comcast explained that the term "hot home," H-O-T, "hot home," means somebody who accesses extreme radical websites. And he notes that my website was the only one that would possibly fit under that category. So he said that this means the following. Comcast monitors the websites that we look at. And the James McCanney is on their list of extremist radical websites. And then says, you get your internet TV service cut off if they don't like the websites you look at. And then what he just reviews what he wrote to the National Weather Service. And he just recounted that warm water does not form hurricanes or tornadoes. He explained that these are caused by electric field between the ionosphere and Earth. He mentioned that lightning strikes in shallow water and over land as proof of the power source being shorted out, causing the storms to dump its water. And then various other comments. And then also recommended extracting power from the ionosphere and using energy to supply electricity to the United States. So anyway, he had his internet and TV and phone, etc., which was with Comcast, all brought down, and it was labeled as a hot home because he was accessing radical websites. Okay, that's interesting. This was about 4 years ago. So I can imagine what they think of me now. Let's see. Okay, and then this is a posting that NASA is beginning a study group, or an observation group, I should say, of the comet C2012S1. And I'll be talking more about this particular setup here in the future, because this doesn't surprise me, but then it's very interesting to see how they're setting this up. Comet Ison C2012S1 is the comet I have been talking about that in October will be have a very close encounter with Mars. Now, the NASA Ison observing campaign only starts in November, a month and a half after its encounter with Mars. And so they only are looking for data from professional observatories. And typically, NASA would be wide open to amateur observation and posting it, etc. But this is only from professional observatories and professionally recognized facilities. And then they say that the data is going to be open. Their whole project here is to facilitate open data between all of this to make it available to the research community so everybody has immediate access within a day of when the data is taken and be able to look at it. But then in the smaller print down below, they say that the data will be housed at the locations where it's taken, And the principal investigators of these locations will be the people who manage the data and will be able to filter it and only let out the data that they deem appropriate. So it's supposed to be open, but it's not. Typical NASA. So I have a whole laundry list of observations that I've made regarding this so-called observation campaign. Excuse me. There are no amateur input. They start in November, a month and a half after probably what has to be the biggest astronomical event in the last 3,000 years that we know is coming, a major comet interacting with one of the inner terrestrial planets. Now, we've seen comets interact with Jupiter, the Schumacher-Levy 9, 21 pieces of that comet hitting Jupiter back in the, many years ago, and on and on and on. So that was back in the 90s, I believe, the Schumacher-Levy 9 comet hitting Jupiter. But this comet, we know in advance, is going to be passing very near Mars. 7 million miles is extremely close. Possibly Mars will disappear in the coma of the comet, and for 2 weeks prior to that, we should be seeing electrical discharges between the comet and Mars. As the comet works up behind Mars, we should see aurora activity on Mars. We could see Mars actually going comet a little bit, see Mars become a comet, atmospheric terraforming events on Mars. This is the biggest celestial event in the last 3,000 years, and NASA is not including it in their observation campaign. It's very clear they're trying to control the information getting out to the public. No amateur input. This is extremely unusual. Only select professionals will be on their list of advisors. The list of experts includes a guy named Kerry Liss, who I've had personal experience with, and by the way, is the person who accidentally, using the NASA equipment back in the 1996 era, accidentally discovered that comets emit X-rays, something that I predicted. I was side by side, nose to nose with these people at the American Geophysical Union meetings, and they ignored me as much as they could, possibly could, not talking to me, not recognizing that my work was right next to theirs. I had predicted this in my earliest papers, that comets would emit X-rays far to the sunward side, and that's exactly what they found with Comet Hyakutake. The other guy who's the co-leader of this group is a guy named Carl Battens. From the military end of the house at the Naval Observatory, he runs what is called the Sungrazer subpage, and is one of the key filters to prevent information from getting to the public regarding a very important class of comets called sungrazers. So you can see right at the beginning, the people that they have chosen to filter the information are people who have done their best to prevent, first of all, my work from being presented and allowed to be presented in the standard scientific community, and have also promoted the fairy tale science that propagates. And also, the reason I'm giving my lectures now the way I am, the education on the spectral analysis of comets, measuring comet nuclear size, which is today's lecture, is because when these people release data, I'm going to tell you what data they do have but are not releasing, okay? So I want you educated as to what that data means and why they're hiding it and why they're letting out the powder puff data. they have a very limited set of viewing objectives, a very limited set of objectives with their observations. The fact that they say the data will be open and available immediately, but then it will not, really. And as I said, it starts in November, a month and a half after the biggest event in astronomical history. I want to mention, too, that regarding Comet Ison, remember a number of weeks ago there was this flap about and I made an announcement on my page saying that that I have data showing that Comet Ison has companions. That means moons. That means objects orbiting the comet. Recently, or since then, NASA has put out a statement that the comet seems to be breaking up, which means that pieces would be coming out of the nucleus and moving away from the nucleus, as obviously trying to cover up the fact that there are companions. But a breakup and companions act totally different. Companions are in orbit around the nucleus. A breakup, they move away and they remain in the same orbit, moving along with the comet nucleus. So clearly these are very different, and I'll make the point again. They're deathly afraid of people seeing comets with companions, and this starts with the Vatican. Remember that NASA is a secret society-controlled entity. And so these are starts from the Vatican, the European bankers, the Rothschilds, these nameless people who sit up there and run the world. One of their biggest issues is with comets. And so this is why my book Comets, that's why my webpage was hacked. That's why they are trying desperately to drown out my message. That's why they have NASA forming a committee 8 months before any observations are to be made. Now, in the end of March, they're forming this alleged committee for viewing Comet Ison 8 months before any viewing session. This is unheralded, and then announcing it to the public, obviously doing serious damage control. So anyway, this is going to get real interesting, folks. Because, the thing that I have on my side is the truth. And the more they lie, the more they squirm, the more they hide data, the more they're going to be exposed. And so they are on the side of a lie. So how do you protect a lie? Well, that's what they're trying to do. And so this year is going to be very interesting. That's all I can tell you. Okay, on to measuring comet nuclei. How to measure the size of a comet nucleus. Okay, so let me just, once again, for those who are not real familiar, let me describe a comet. Now, of course, the traditional view, and I want to describe both sides, the traditional view, and then, of course, my theory, the plasma discharge comet model, so that you have a basis for comparison. The standard model says that the comet is this is from standard science, which of course is, I call it fairy tale science. It started with Kepler, but anyway, that a comet is an ice ball. When it gets near the sun, it melts and the tail material flows away from the sun because of the heat of the sun, and that's a comet. Okay, pretty basic, not a lot there. Should do some very basic things, nothing more. It sure shouldn't be creating X-rays. But at any rate, my concept is that a comet nucleus is any kind of rocky object. It could have ice on it. It doesn't need ice. But typically it would be a hot, dry rock, or dry rock coming in from the far reaches of the solar system or beyond. And when it comes into the solar system, it discharges the solar capacitor. It's a capacitor built up because there's a excess positive charge in the solar wind that's constantly blowing off of the sun. This creates a capacitor, and just like the backyard bug killer, when the bug flies in between the charged plates, zap, it zaps the bug and the bug falls down. Well, a comet is the same thing, same type of thing. It flies into a capacitor and it begins to discharge. Okay, what happens? In the discharge, since the electrons are the bulk charge carriers, they have a smaller charge to mass ratio, they provide the bulk charge carrier in this discharge. So since the bulk charge carrier is electrons coming out from the sun, they collect like a rock in a river with a stream, it develops a pressure on the sunward side, and that pressure is translated into electric charge, negative electric charge. Now you have a negatively charged region around the comet nucleus, so it starts attracting in all of the positively charged dust and gases, etc., in that region of the solar system, so it becomes a large cosmic vacuum cleaner drawing this material in. And so this electrical discharge passing through the comet from the sunward side, it passes around the nucleus, keeps going out, it's attracting all this tail material. If there are negative ions, they get pushed out in this electrical current. And so all of this activity is going on. That's why there are X-rays to the far sunward side of the comet nuclei, because the electron beam, if it's intense enough, interacts. That's why some comets light up like a light bulb, because you literally have an electrical current flowing through it. All of these characteristics that standard science wants to ignore are there. So anyway, the question is, okay, the comet starts to form, the tail starts to form, the coma, you cannot see the nucleus anymore. How do you measure the size of the comet nucleus? Something that you cannot see. So anyway, I'm going to go through a whole laundry list here of scientific things you can do to measure the comet nucleus. Okay, first of all, as this nucleus is coming in, if you can locate it, which is very difficult, but say you could locate it with automated search equipment, which is getting better and better all the time. NASA has these. The military has super equipment that they use. You have the Hubble Space Telescope out there constantly taking pictures, doing sky surveys. You have the other equipment out there in outer space that can see things. So if you get an advanced warning to where the nucleus is still visible with reflected sunlight and the coma has not developed around it, you could directly measure it with a good measurement with a telescope. You could tell, okay, here's the orbit. We know how far away it is. Here's how much space it takes up in a telescope camera, and that's how big it is. So a direct measurement early on is one way that it could be done, and especially with the bigger comets, the ones that are big. And I know that NASA has these search facilities out there looking for these. They've already discovered, they say, 90 objects out there that are bigger than Pluto. And so this was a number of years ago. So you know they have a big catalog of these objects. Not all of them come into the solar system. Not all of them become comets because they don't come into these far enough into the solar system. But so anyway, that's one way to measure a comet nucleus, is to catch it before it develops into a comet and measure it directly. You can, once the comet develops, you can make an estimate of the size of the nucleus by the size of the coma, by the size of the electrical discharge, by the size of using past experience. And so this is not a very good method, because if the comet is small but in a very active area of the solar system, it could develop a very large coma and tail, whereas a bigger nucleus might be in a less active region of the solar system and it would not develop a very big tail. So it's a very poor method of trying to estimate comet nuclei, the size of a comet nucleus. And so this is the one that NASA relies on. They got their laundry list of experts, and they must have a rabbit's hat where they pull a number out and they go, oh, this one seems to be a little bigger than normal. But I've noticed in news releases that they are all over the board. One group is saying 600 feet across. The other one is saying 26 kilometers across. And so NASA can't keep its story straight. The right hand and the left hand don't have their act together. They're not communicating. And so it really is obvious to someone who is experienced in looking at this, that the NASA, but they rely on this, oh, an expert told me so type of thing. So at any rate, there's people trying to call, whatever. So that's a very poor method, and it's something that I would not rely on. other than if the comet is really, really big. Now, let's take a look at Comet Lovejoy. The Comet Lovejoy went through the sun atmosphere. It came out the other side, and people saw the nucleus of Comet Lovejoy. This was last year. They saw the nucleus of Comet Lovejoy with their naked eye next to the sun before the sun came up in the morning. And remember, never look at the sun with your eyes or optical equipment, binoculars. Never look directly at the sun with your eyes because you'll damage them. And make sure if you're with your kids, make sure they understand that too. But Comet Lovejoy, the nucleus was visible next to the sun. And we can see Mercury, for example, for comparison, we can see Mercury in the morning, early morning sky, and it's just kind of a little dot, but if you know what to look for, you can actually see it with your naked eye, just like you can see the planet Mars or the planet Venus or planet Jupiter or Saturn. Those are the visible planets. So the ancients all knew about Mercury, the little winged carrier, the fleet-footed winged carrier around the sun. Mercury. So when you see something bigger than Mercury, you know that it's bigger than a planet. Mercury is a small planet, but this was much bigger. And then the nucleus developed a tail again and became one of the biggest comets in history. After passing through the solar atmosphere, and NASA goes, oh, that's just a 600-foot-wide little thing. And we certainly don't know why it lasted through the sun. Well, of course, that's totally absurd. It's fairy tale science that a little ice ball could go through the sun and somehow last. That's just beyond absurd. It's just the level of absurdity is just beyond any rational estimate of comprehension. Okay, now let's get into some serious methods of measuring comet nuclei. Radio signals. Okay, now this method of measuring and detecting and determining conditions is very old, very well known, very well understood. And what you do is you send a radio signal from a radio telescope on Earth, one of the big arrays or the Arecibo radio telescope. You send a signal out in the direction of the comet nucleus. Just to give an example, when Venus, they were starting to explore Venus and the Arecibo telescope facility was new, they sent a beam out to Venus. It gave them a very accurate measure of the size of the planet Venus, of the surface, because the atmosphere is gigantic around Venus. You can't see the surface. On Earth, you can, from outer space, you can see the surface of the planet. On Venus, you can't. So at any rate, they sent a radio signal out, and it came back, and they knew because of the structure of the radio signal that returned, that reflected off of Venus, that Venus was highly cratered. There were many, many craters on Venus. And so anyway, Carl Sagan said, well, see, that proves that Venus is very old because it has many craters. Well, it wasn't until 20, 30 years later when the Magellan probe went out to Venus that proved that, yes, in fact, Venus had many craters, but they were young volcanic craters. Venus literally had millions of volcanic craters, active volcanic craters, on its surface, which proved that Venus is a young planet. So just one more of Carl Sagan's blunders, which nobody wants to talk about, but since I lived through this whole era, I can recount these things, put them together, and bring this information to you. But at any rate, one of the early points of data on Venus came from radio signal, sending a signal out from the Arecibo big radio telescope in the limestone hills and mountains of central Puerto Rico. And then that radio signal bounces off the planet Venus and comes back. Well, the same technique can be used for comet nuclei. You send out a signal and you can read the information that comes back. A big nucleus is going to give you a lot more reflected signal. A small nucleus, of course, is not going to reflect much. But that radio signal can penetrate the comet coma And that is a method that I guarantee you NASA is using to measure the properties, the spin rate, the all kinds of properties of the comet nuclei. It's using that but hiding the data. And so they're using this estimate by an expert is what they pawn off on the public. What they're really doing is measuring with radio signals, and they have the data, but they're obviously letting the lie go, letting the misinformation go out there for the public consumption, because they're letting an expert make an estimate based on what they believe is the dirty snowball comet model. And of course, that's totally erroneous. Comet Hale-Bopp, for example, I saw a photo of the nucleus of Comet Hale-Bopp when it left the solar system, and it was the size of our moon. It had grown considerably from the time it came in the solar system about 6 years earlier. It had grown constantly, and that changed its orbit. That accumulation of mass changed its orbit from a 4,200-year period orbit, comet orbit, to about 2,600 years. Okay, so Comet Hale-Bopp will be back in 2,600 years. The next time, it'll be even a bigger change, so maybe around 1,300 years. So eventually, Comet Hale-Bopp will work into the solar system and eventually will have an encounter with Earth. So that could be in 2,600 years, or about 4,000 years, or about 5,000 years. Each time it comes back, it's going to reduce its orbit, but it is an Earth-crossing orbit. Comet Hale-Bopp will interact with Earth at some point. We're going to be close enough in our orbit, but it's hard to predict because we don't know what the mass accumulation of that comet will be because of it dragging in the tail material. Okay, so anyway, but using radio techniques is the tried and sure accurate way to measure all the properties of the comet nucleus. NASA is doing this. They're not releasing the data. Okay, measuring a comet nucleus after it leaves the solar system, like I saw with Hale-Bopp. After the comet coma disrupts, it's no longer active. Now the nucleus is moving out of the solar system. If you can, you should be able to find it easily because you know what the orbit is. Just wait till that coma clears and then snap a picture of it. Or once again, use radio telescope techniques and you can easily determine the size of that comet. Okay, the one method which is very accurate, very easy to use, something anybody can do, is if the comet has a companion. So that means a moon. And this is an astronomical technique. You take the orbital period of the companion. Using your telescope and equipment, you measure the radius of the orbit or other orbital properties. In other words, how long does it take for that moon to go around the major nucleus of the comet? Okay, you take those two factors, you plug them into a very simple little equation, and it gives you the mass of the nucleus. This same technique is used by astronomers to measure the mass of stars, distant stars. If you can find a star with a companion planet, and you can measure the period and, the period of rotation and the distance of that planet from the central star, things that you can measure and estimate and do secondary estimates based on other data, you can put those same factors into this little equation, and it gives you the mass of the central star. So it's a well-known, well-understood basic equation based on sound physics. So if the nucleus has a companion, you can easily determine the mass of the nucleus by making those simple measurements that any amateur could make using a telescope. And that's why NASA and the astronomical community, which is controlled by the secret societies, the bankers of Europe, the Vatican, etc., that's why they are deathly afraid of comets coming in with companions. Because, number one, the public could realize that the actual size of the comet nuclei, that they are not little teeny pea-sized things. And that I got a kick out of this last week. that NASA now is calling comet nuclei pea-sized, you know, the little pea between your fingers, pea-sized, indicating small, really, really small. But no, comet nuclei can be big. Actually, the vast majority of comet nuclei are small. The vast majority don't come near Earth to cause any type of harm to Earth. Comets are coming in and moving around the solar system every day of the year. There's dozens of them out there at any given time, and they don't have any effect on us at all. Certain comets will have effects on us, but at any rate, one of the important factors, one of the important things to try and understand is the size of the comet nucleus. But having companions is very important, and that's why when I made the announcement that Comet Ison appears to have companions, then NASA comes out and says, no, it's breaking up, which means now let's go out into outer space and let's imagine two different scenarios. One is that the comet nucleus comes in with a companion. Okay, that companion is orbiting the central nucleus, just like a solar system, just like a mini solar system. And I have said, too, that if Planet X comes into this solar system, first it will take the form of a giant comet, but it'll have all of these secondary comets orbiting around it. And that's the kind of thing. If you see that up in the sky, you know that that could mean trouble, because the nucleus is big. It could develop into a big comet that could be Earth-affecting. Okay, so at any rate, the point is that by seeing something orbiting a comet nucleus, you know right off the bat that that's a big nucleus. It's not some little pea-sized poof ball. Okay, so NASA comes out recently with this story that Comet Ison is breaking up. Okay, so let's imagine a cometary breakup. A piece breaks off of the main nucleus and starts to drift away from the main nucleus. Okay, these objects are moving along in the basically the same velocity, and the other smaller piece is breaking off and moving away. Okay, so they're moving in unison. The smaller piece that broke off is not in orbit. It's not orbiting the main nucleus, so it's a very different scenario. So for them to say that something is breaking up when it's really a companion, once again, it's a way of lying, covering up the real information. And I don't know, I don't have the final word on Comet Ison yet to see if it has companions, but that is something that's being worked on, something that I'm working on to get real information. And as I said, the companions, the moons of a nucleus of a comet, would be orbiting. So you'd be able to see them orbiting and moving around the comet nucleus, whereas a breakup, they would be moving along kind of like similar paths, one out in front of the other one or something like that. Okay, the last method for directly measuring, not the last, but the second to the last method for directly measuring a comet nucleus is with direct satellite measurement. In other words, send a satellite out there. Now, one of my main criticisms over the year of NASA is that every time they want to do something, they have to build a special satellite. Millions and millions and millions of dollars for a satellite that does one thing, or it has one objective, or one objective in terms of a place to go and look at. Or sometimes they double them up, but basically they're onesie-twosies. They build one. They built two of the Voyager spacecraft. Well, at the time I said, what are you building two for? It's like building one car. You know, to build one car, it takes a lot of resources to make the molds, to make the everything, to make the engine, to make all the parts of the engine and everything. To make one car is stupid. It's ridiculously stupid. But that's what NASA does. And that's how they keep their monopoly on space. No, when you build a spacecraft that's designed to go out and work and measure plasma and electrical conditions or plasma conditions or magnetic fields or has cameras, no, you build thousands of them and you launch them and you send them all over the solar system. Now you have thousands and thousands of data points and you can do real science. You send out two or the stereo view of the sun. Okay, that's swell. But you could build 20 more spacecraft just like that for almost nothing, because now you got all the parts, the molds, the design, etc. So at any rate, to build one spacecraft or two is absurd. But it, see, that maintains the NASA monopoly, and everybody thinks, well, only NASA can do this. No, they should have thousands and thousands of these spacecraft roaming around the solar system doing things, and especially going out to visit comets. Direct measurement. And by the way, in the direct measurement about the 7 comet nuclei that have been photographed directly lately, the comet nuclei have no ice, no snow, no water. There's nothing coming off of the NASA artist conceptions making them look like a steam engine. Nobody has ever seen anything like that, including the Temple 1, where they crashed the probe into the nucleus of comet Temple 1, and dust flew out. And they go, oh, the water must be deeper. Well, it's a moot point. There's nothing coming off that nucleus. There's no snow, ice, or water, and there's no vapor coming out of the nucleus to create the tail. End of story. Okay. The last way you could see tell a comet nucleus is if the comet nucleus is really, really big. And for this, I want you to look at the cover of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. There's an example of an Indian rock petroglyph, Native American Indian rock petroglyph from Green River, Utah, where the comet is drawn twice, once with the nucleus highly visible. And because comet nuclei are minimum 100,000 miles across, this planetary nucleus of this comet in that picture had to be at least 100,000 miles across, bigger than Jupiter, probably. So at any rate, most comet nuclei are not big, but certainly they can be. Okay, so once again, I'll be concentrating on hardcore science throughout this year, dealing with comets, dealing with electrical conditions in the solar system. Remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The books are listed right at the top. And go to the sales page. Remember the water filters, my own personal products that are unavailable anyplace else, which is the pre-filter, the ChemRad oil pre-filter. Fits any gravity feed water filter system. The modular filtration and storage system filters and stores up to 20 gallons of water, and you can add additional tanks onto that up to unlimited amount of storage. The emergency survival recalendar sun star clock, which gives you an understanding of our solar system, the sun and the stars, and allows you to recalendar in case of emergency, produce the clock and calendar in case of emergency. And I am out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.